I am making a change in the order of service. Executive decision. Mary. I'm going to do the reading first, and then we'll do a meditation. So the reading is by Reverend Jesse Jackson about the last 2 days of his life. Jesse Jackson remembers this. Dr. King was tired and thinking of retiring from the civil rights movement. After all, he marched in some of the most volatile, unwelcoming places in the country, as well as being jailed and nearly fatally stabbed. King considered being a full-time author, accepting a position with his alma mater, Morehouse College, but his resolve to continue was suddenly refreshed. He said, "You know, we can't now. We got to go on. We got to turn a minus to a plus, like we did before. It's like," and Jackson says, "it's like Martin preached to himself out of his depression. Ours turned out to be an interesting session that Saturday before going into Memphis, a kind of prelude. On April 3rd, 1968, King had been contemplative and somewhat sad. He sat in his room most of the day reminiscing about his past, about how his dad met his granddad, the Reverend A.D. Williams, and how his dad met his mom, kind of reminiscing a lot that day," says Jackson, who was then a 27-year-old aide to King. That evening, King wanted to stay in his motel room at the Lorraine, and worked on moving forward with the Poor People's Campaign, which the Southern Christian Leadership Conference had postponed in order to support Memphis striking garbage workers. King sent Jackson and his other associates, including Reverend Ralph Abernathy, to Mason Temple to attend a rally. "So Ralph said to me, 'Jesse, they're not cheering us. They're cheering because they think Martin is behind us.' And we laughed about it. So we went down to the front of the church and we called Dr. King and said, 'You really ought to come.' King did come that rainy evening to the church, but was only supposed to speak a few minutes after Abernathy's introduction. He got up without a single note and began to reminisce," Jackson recalled. "He kind of walked back through history, as he'd done before earlier that day, but talked about his own family life. He had no way of knowing the kind of pressures he was under that he internalized and simply would not share. No, I'm sorry. We had no way of knowing the kind of pressures he had underneath that he internalized and simply would not share." King's voice grew increasingly electric, increasingly powerful, and it built to these words that now echo in history. "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We got some difficult days ahead, but it doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he allowed me to go up to the mountain, and I looked over, and I seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to that promised land, and I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Jackson said King's mood was much better the next day. In the evening, they prepared for dinner at Reverend Samuel Billy Kyle's home. And King joked to Jackson, "Jesse, we're on the way to Reverend Kyle's home for dinner, and you don't have a tie on." I said, "Doc, the prerequisite for eating is an appetite, not a tie." King then just gestured to Ben Branch, the leader of the band Jackson had brought down from Memphis. He said, "Ben, be sure to play my favorite song tonight." precious Lord. I invite you at this time to get in a comfortable position if you desire. Feet on the floor if you wish, close your eyes. And to focus on the Serenity Prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr, which became the prayer for Alcoholics Anonymous and for so many other organizations. We'll think about the meaning of this prayer in your thoughts. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. And God, give me the courage to change the things I can. And finally, God, grant me the wisdom to know the difference. I invite you to gently come back into the sanctuary and be among friends. The idea for this sermon came from an encounter I had with an African-American man near the First Congregational Church in downtown Kalamazoo as I was rushing to go to participate in the Messiah sing-along. Were any of you there at that time? No. Well, it's a wonderful experience. Oh, you went? Good. It's a wonderful experience. I recommend it. You don't have to sing. You can come just listen. But I was late, and I was feeling irritated. And for the life of me, I can't remember why I was feeling irritated. Maybe because I was late. This man was like me. He was a big guy, about my weight, my height. And he had on what I thought was a nice winter jacket. So he comes up to me and says, "Could you give me some money? I need some money so I can go home, back home to Battle Creek." So I fish into my wallet, and I pull out a dollar bill and give it to him. And then with great disdain, he said, "A dollar? That's all? I need more money than that." So I then went into a calculation about this giving process. It's really complicated, actually. I knew that I had in my wallet, originally I had four $1 bills, and I had two 20s. So I knew I wasn't going to give them a 20. But I also knew that in the church, they were going to do a collection. And I knew I wasn't going to give them a 20 either. So I was thinking, I want to give them, you know, $3. If I had a five, I'd give them five, you know. That was my calculation. And plus, I was getting more irritated. I didn't like being shamed into giving more money. I know you understand this, right? During stewardship days. And I said, hey, man, if it's not enough, give it back to me. He said, no, man, I just need more money. And I said, well, haven't you heard the saying that beggars can't be choosers? No, I haven't. Well, you're just going to have to accept what I have given you. And then he said, but at this rate, I'll be out here in the cold for hours trying to get the money. And I looked at him and I said, my friend, life is tough. This vignette reminds me of a psychological experiment done at the Princeton Seminary in 1977. The seminarians were to prepare a speech about the Good Samaritan parable. And then they were to walk across the campus and go to a studio and give this speech to their supervisors. You know this? Yeah. Okay. The seminarians were divided into two groups. The first were told that they were late for their presentation. They needed to get over there, toot sweet. And the other were told that they had plenty of time, but they were advised to go over anyway and be ready to give the speech. So the seminarians would go alone, each one of them. And along the way, they would encounter a man who slumped down and coughing, obviously in need of help. This man is an accomplice in the experiment. They were trying to determine, to discover how the seminarians would behave. And I imagine you would know, right? The ones who had plenty of time, more than half took the time to help the man. 90% of the ones who didn't have time did not stop. That's violating the essence of their religion and of the principles of the main principle of the Good Samaritan parable. Obviously, those participants would not share with this man their most precious gift, their time. So I look at myself in this encounter with the man, and I wonder, why did I tell that man life's tough? What are the odds that a black man, especially a big black man, would not know that, who lives in America? And it's obvious this man is a man not of means, right? He's out in the cold, the dark, asking for money, which is not an easy thing to do in American culture. And I'm thinking, well, perhaps he just needs reminding. I think that's what ministry is. We just remind people of things. We don't tell them anything new. He needed to be reminded that it's important to accept reality as it is and not as he wished it to be. But perhaps I too needed to be reminded to accept reality, which might have helped me to be more thoughtful, to be kinder, even though I was in a rush. I thought to myself later, I could have invited this man to the Messiah and to listen to this wonderful music. And then I could say, well, we can get together after the service and we can talk. And maybe I could find a way to help him. Not me. We could work together, maybe. Find a way to help him. What is important here is both of us lacked an important quality, acceptance. Now, earlier I had you meditate on the Serenity Prayer by Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So we begin with this question. What is it that we cannot change? What is it that we cannot change? I think, for example, is that we can't change other people. At least we cannot control them. We can have influence in their lives, but we cannot control them, even those who are closest to us. We also cannot control world events. We cannot eliminate poverty, racism, misogyny, violence, hatred, at least not by ourselves, and not in our own lifetimes. So how do we respond to that which we cannot change? The Serenity Prayer gives us the answer: acceptance. And acceptance does not mean that we do nothing. And it does not mean that we have to feel good about the evils that exist in the world. Indeed, there are times it's important to feel angry and frustration, or what Martin Luther King Jr. called creative maladjustment. Acceptance means simply acknowledging what is true and living with that truth. It means being kind with ourselves, realistic about life, being able to enjoy life simply because we are alive. But what about the other part of the prayer? What is it that we can change? You thought about it. What is it that we can change? Yes, ourselves. What we can change is our own racism, our own misogyny, our own intense anger, our own apathy and cynicism. But that would take some doing. That would take some doing. First, we must acknowledge those parts of ourselves, the dark corners of our souls. And even then, it will take some effort for us to change, because to change is uncomfortable. Thus, it requires courage to change. Now, another reason I feel a need to do this sermon is that there seems to be a kind of consensus that this past year has been a difficult one. Do you all agree with that? Does anybody disagree with that? It sure seems that way, doesn't it? And as a matter of fact, where did I put that? Here it is. Aha. There was this cartoon in the Gazette, December 30th edition. Did you all see this cartoon? Steve Breen, Union Tribune in San Diego. And what it is a cartoon, and there's old man 2014 lying on the ground. He's gasping for breath. The hourglass is almost empty on one side. And the doctor has an IV in him and holding his wrist, taking his pulse. And says, "I know it's been a rough one. Only a few more days to go." And on his legs is a list. And the list says, "Ukraine, ISIS, beheadings, Ebola, Ferguson, riots, shootings, Cosby, scandal, hacking." This list could have included much more very important events in the world. For example, refugees. Do you know that now there are more refugees than there have ever been since World War II? Could have included Gaza or could include North Korea, Syria. As far as diseases go, you could include malaria, which kills millions of people in the world. Ebola kills less than 10,000. which it's a very serious disease. But as you can tell, there's so much more that could go on that list. And given all the bad news that we hear that inundates our airwaves, it's understandable that we would think that our troubles are more difficult, more onerous, that they're different than other eras. It's natural that we think that way. But that comes from our lack of the acceptance of truth, that life has always been tough. And there have been times in our history that have been even more challenging. Consider Theodore Parker, who was perhaps the most influential American Unitarian minister who ever lived. He was one of the greatest American preachers, the leader, along with Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller, of the Transcendentalist movement, a major anti-slavery leader and theorist about democracy. He was one of the first American clergymen to endorse women's suffrage, and he was the first, and I think this is very interesting, he was the first to refer to God as both father and mother. He once defined democracy as government of all the people, by all the people, for all the people, which influenced Abraham Lincoln in his creation of the Gettysburg Address. And Parker's words have influenced Martin Luther King Jr. when he wrote, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." I bring Parker to your attention because he does represent our best traditions and values. His piece in the Words for Reflection come from a sermon called Religion Which Is Needed, which was written in 1858, at a time that our country was more divided than it has ever been in our history. Nevertheless, Parker wrote, "We are to outlearn these five evils, war, wicked government, slavery, selfish antagonism in society, and the degradation of women. We shall outgrow these things." We shall outgrow these things. He is speaking to us still this day. He's telling us that life is tough, but we can really do what makes the world a better place. We can act. We can make this world better for ourselves and our children and future generations. I also draw your attention to Clarence Skinner, an early 20th century Universalist minister and professor of applied Christianity at Crane Theological School at Tufts University, which was founded by Universalists, by the way. He preached the social gospel of Christ's message to reform all society, to make it more compassionate for all people, that all people are treated with respect. We note in his words, from that are in the order of service, is from his book, The Social Implications of Universalism, written in 1915, in which he said, "Universalists are free men." Of course, now free, we should include women. "Therefore, they should be in the front rank of the daring few who are fighting the battles for social emancipation." The daring few to fight the battles. Social emancipation. Skinner lived his creed, even when it was difficult to do so. He spoke out against entering what was then called the Great War, now called World War I. He got pushback from that. He got criticism from his own students and from his own colleagues at Tufts. In the 1920s, he was active in the defense of Sacco and Vanzetti, whom he felt were unjustly convicted of murder based on their political radicalism. Both Skinner and Parker knew that they could not control the situations of their day. But they also knew that they had the power to do what was fitting and right, even though they could never know how their words would change things. But they did know that their contributions can make a difference. I close with some thoughts about Martin Luther King Jr., who I venture to say knew this concept, life is tough. When Martin Luther King Jr. died, he had many critics on the left and the right, from journalists, politicians, even from other members in the civil rights movement. His championing of nonviolent resistance garnered him criticism from Malcolm X, who said that Martin's philosophy played into the hands of the white oppressors, that they, the white oppressors, were happy to hear him talk about love of oppressors because that disarmed the Negro, who would be shaped into a stereotype of the Negro being meek, turning the other cheek kind of creature. Malcolm was not alone among the more militant blacks who criticized Martin. In his final years, he organized a campaign to end poverty and promote economic justice. That alienated him with the power elite, the business class, the people that used to support him when he was only fighting segregation. And finally, he alienated President Lyndon Johnson, who has done more for African Americans, arguably, than any other president, save Abraham Lincoln. When King gave an important speech opposing the Vietnam War at the Riverside Church in New York City, a year to the day before he died, on April 4th, 1967, he gave this speech. In that speech, he connected the evils of racism, poverty, and militarism. But that eloquent, prophetic speech that is as timely now as it was then offended the power elite. So it was a lonely time for Martin, the last year of his life. Life was indeed tough. I dare say his life was tougher than few of any of us could know. Now, we heard from the reading today, Jesse Jackson talking in Martin's last days, how he was so despairing, wanting to quit. He was offered the presidency at Morehouse College. And I think to myself, God, Martin, why don't you take it? Why don't you find some respite, some quiet? Live an ordinary life. You deserve it, my friend. Your life has been so tough, so dangerous, so treacherous. I understand your desire to find ease, comfort, and safety for yourself and your family. But he preached to himself to give himself strength and hope. And the night before he died, he gave that famous "I've been to the mountaintop" speech. The next day he seemed happy, almost as if he came to terms with his own death, and he was relieved. As the song says, "Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, help me stand." Martin Luther King was a Christian. He turned to his faith to help him. It was a faith that helped him to preach the radical message that Jesus of Nazareth taught, the message of love. Not just loving your family and friends, that's easy. And every religion teaches that. The radical message from Jesus was to love your enemies. And that's what Martin Luther King Jr. did. Over and over again, he demonstrated his strength to not return hate with hate, but with love and compassion. Now, I'm not a Christian. Much of Christian theology does not make sense to me. Indeed, much of many religions' theologies do not make sense to me. But I find religion in Christianity, as I do in other religions. But I'm also in awe of the strength of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. to continue his ministry, even when he knew it was dangerous to do so. Whether that strength comes from his religion or not is not important to me. For what is important is this. It's not what your religion is, but what does your religion do for you? Does it give you comfort and strength during your times of trouble? Does it make you a better person, kinder, and more just? Does it help you go out into the world and to do that which is fitting and right? For in the final analysis, we can know that life is tough for all of us. And during those times, we confront the difficulties in our lives. It's not our religion that's important, or our philosophy, or even our faith. It is our love.